"Where is my chaperone?" the woman asked, in a quiet, distracted voice.
"And who might your chaperone be, madame?" Mallory said, a bit dizzily. "I don't think your friends were any proper sort of escort for a lady."
Mallory was bleeding from the wound in his left thigh. It was seeping through his trouser leg. He sat heavily in the worn plush of the seat, pressed his palm against his wounded leg, and peered into the woman's veil. Elaborate ringlets, pale and seeming shot with grey, showed the sustained attentions of a gifted lady's maid. But the face seemed to possess a strange familiarity.
"Do I know you, madame?" Mallory asked.
There was no answer.
"May I escort you?" he suggested. "Do you have any proper friends at the Derby, madame? Someone to look after you?"
"The royal enclosure," she murmured.
"You desire to go to the royal enclosure?"
The idea of troubling the royal family with this dazed, mad woman was rather more than Mallory was willing to countenance. Then it struck him that it would be a very simple matter to find police there, and this was a police business of some kind, without a doubt. Humouring the unhappy woman would be his simplest course of action.
"Very well, ma'am," he said.
He tucked the wooden box under one arm and offered her his other elbow.
"We shall proceed at once to the royal enclosure. If you would come with me, please."
Mallory led her toward the stands, through a torrent of people, limping a bit. As they walked, she seemed to recover herself somewhat. Her gloved hand rested on his forearm as lightly as a cobweb. Mallory waited for a break in the hubbub. He found one at last, beneath the whited pillars of the stands.
"May I introduce myself, ma'am? My name is Edward Mallory. I'm a fellow of the Royal Society, a paleontologist."
"The Royal Society," the woman muttered absently, her veiled head nodding like a flower on a stalk. She seemed to murmur something further.
"I beg your pardon?"
"The Royal Society. We have sucked the life blood from the mysteries of the universe." Mallory stared. "The fundamental relations in the science of harmony," the woman continued, in a voice of deep gentility, great weariness, and profound calm, "are susceptible to mechanical expression, allowing the composition of elaborate and scientific pieces of music of any degree of complexity or extent."
"To be sure," Mallory soothed.
"I think, gentlemen," the woman whispered, "that when you see certain productions of mine, you will not despair of me. In their own way, my marshalled regiments shall ably serve the rulers of the earth. And of what materials shall my regiments consist? Vast numbers." She had seized Mallory's arm with feverish intensity. "We shall march in irresistible power to the sound of music." She turned her veiled face to him with a queer, sprightly earnestness. "Is not this very mysterious? Certainly my troops must consist of numbers, or they can have no existence at all. But then, what are these numbers? There is a riddle."
"Is this your box, ma'am?"
Mallory said, offering it to her, hoping to spark some return to sense. She looked at the box, without apparent recognition. It was a handsome thing of polished rosewood, its corners bound in brass. It might have been a lady's glove box, but it was too stark, and lacked elegance. The long lid was latched shut by a pair of tiny brass hooks. She reached out to stroke it with a gloved forefinger, as if assuring herself of its physical existence. Something about it seemed to sting her into a dawning recognition of her own distress.
"Will you hold it for me, sir?"
she asked Mallory at last, her quiet voice trembling with a strange, piteous appeal.
"Will you hold it for me in safekeeping?"
"Of course," Mallory said, touched despite himself. "Of course I will hold it for you. As long as you like, madame."
They worked their way slowly up the stands to the carpeted stairs that led to the royal enclosure. Mallory's leg smarted sharply, and his trouser was sticky with blood. He was dizzier than he felt he should have been from such a minor wound. Something about the woman's queer speech and odder demeanour had turned his head. Or perhaps, the dark thought occurred to him, there had been some sort of venom coating the tout's stiletto. He was sorry now that he had not snatched up the stiletto for a later analysis. Perhaps the mad woman too had been somehow narcotized.
Likely he had foiled some dark plot of abduction. Below them, the track had been cleared for the coming gurney race. 5 massive gurneys and the tiny, bauble-like Zephyr were taking their places. Mallory paused a moment, torn, contemplating the frail craft upon which his fortunes now so absurdly hinged. The woman took that moment to release his arm and hastened toward the whitewashed walls of the royal box. Mallory, surprised, hurried after her, limping. She paused for a moment beside a pair of guards at the door, plain-clothed policemen, it seemed, very tall and fit. The woman brushed aside her veil with a swift gesture of habit, and Mallory caught his first proper glimpse of her face. She was Ada Byron, the daughter of the Prime Minister. Lady Ada Byron, the Queen of Engines. She slipped through the door beyond the guards without so much as a glance behind her or a single word of thanks. Mallory, lugging the rosewood box, hurried after her at once.
"Wait!" he cried. "Your ladyship!"
"Just a moment, sir,"
the larger policeman said quite politely. He held up a beefy hand, looked Mallory up and down, noting the wooden case, the dampened trouser leg. His moustached mouth quirked.
"Are you a guest in the royal enclosure, sir?"
"No," Mallory said. "But you must have seen Lady Ada step through here a moment ago. Something quite dreadful has happened to her. I'm afraid she's in some distress. I was able to be of some assistance."
"Your name, sir?"
barked the second policeman.
"Edward Miller,"
Mallory blurted, a sudden chill of protective suspicion striking him at the last instant.
"May I see your citizen card, Mr. Miller?"
said the first policeman.
"What's in that box you carry? May I look inside it, please?"
Mallory swung the box away, took a step back. The policeman stared at him with a volatile mix of disdain and suspicion. There was a loud report from the track below. Steam whistled from a ruptured seam in the Italian gurney, fogging out across the stands like a geyser. There was some small panic in the stands. Mallory seized this opportunity to hobble off. The policeman, worried perhaps about the safety of their post, did not choose to pursue him. He hurried, limping, down the stands, losing himself as soon as possible amid the crowd. Some notion of self-preservation caused him to snatch his striped engineer's cap from his head and shove it in the pocket of his coat. He found a place in the stands, many yards from the royal enclosure. He balanced the brass-bound box across his knees. There was a trifling rip in his trouser leg, but the wound beneath it was still oozing. Mallory grimaced in confusion as he sat and pressed the palm of his hand against the aching wound.
"Damn me,"
said a man on the bench behind him, his voice thick with self-assurance and drink.
"This false start will take the pressure down. Simple matter of specific heat. It means the biggest boiler wins surely."
"Which one's that, then?"
said the man's companion. Perhaps his son. The man ruffled through a racing tip-sheet.
"That'll be the Goliath, Lord Hansel's racer. Our sister craft won last year."
Mallory looked down upon the hoof-beaten track. The driver of the Italian racer was being carried off on a stretcher, having been extricated with some difficulty from the cramped confines of his pilot's station. A column of dirty steam still rose from the rent in the Italian boiler. Racing attendants hitched a team of horses to the disabled hulk. Tall white gouts rose briskly from the stacks of the other racers. The crenellations of polished brass crowning the stack of the Goliath were especially impressive. It utterly dwarfed the slender, peculiarly delicate stack of Godwin's Zephyr, braced with guy wires, which repeated in cross-section the teardrop formula of line-streaming.
"A terrible business," opined the young man. "I do believe the burst took that poor foreigner's head clean off, quite."
"Not a bit of it," said the older man. "Fella had a fancy helmet."
"He's not moving, sir."
"If the Italians can't compete properly in the technical arena, they've no business here," the older man said sternly.
A roar of appreciation came from the crowd as the disabled steamer was hauled free by the labouring horses.
"We'll see some proper sport now," said the older man.
Mallory, waiting tensely, found himself opening the rosewood box, his thumbs moving on the little brass catches as if by their own volition. The interior, lined with green baize, held a long stack of milky white cards. He plucked one free from the middle of the stack. It was an engine punch card, cut to a French specialty gauge and made of some bafflingly smooth artificial material. One corner bore the handwritten annotation, "Number 154,
in faint mauve ink. Mallory tucked the card carefully back into place and shut the box. A flag was waved, and the gurneys were off. The Goliath and the French Vulcan lurched at once into the lead. The unaccustomed delay, the fatal delay, Mallory thought, his heart crushed within him, had cooled the tiny boiler of the Zephyr, leading no doubt to a vital loss of impetus. The Zephyr rolled in the wake of the greater machines, bumping half-comically in their deep-gouged tracks. It could not seem to get a proper traction. Mallory did not find himself surprised. He was full of fatal resignation. Vulcan and Goliath began to jostle for position at the first turn. The three other gurneys fell into file behind them. The Zephyr, quite absurdly, took the widest possible turn, far outside the tracks of the other craft. Master Second Degree Henry Chesterton, at the wheel of the tiny craft, seemed to have gone quite mad. Mallory watched with the numb calm of a ruined man. The Zephyr lurched into an impossible burst of speed. It slipped past the other gurneys with absurd, buttery ease, like a slimy pumpkin seed squeezed between thumb and forefinger. At the half-mile turn, its velocity quite astonishing, it teetered visibly onto two wheels. At the final lap, it struck a slight rise, the entire vehicle becoming visibly airborne. The great driving wheels rebounded from earth with a gout of dust and a metallic screech. It was only at that moment that Mallory realized that the great crowd in the stands had fallen into deathly silence. Not a peep rose from them as the Zephyr whizzed across the finish line. It slithered to a halt then, bumping violently across the gouged tracks left by the competition. A full 4 seconds passed before the stunned track man managed to wave his flag. The other gurneys were still rounding a distant bend a full 100 yards behind. The crowd suddenly burst into astonished outcry, not joy so much as utter disbelief, and even a queer sort of anger. Henry Chesterton stepped from the Zephyr. He tossed back a neck scarf, leaned at his ease against the shining hull of his craft, and watched with cool insolence as the other gurneys laboured painfully across the finish line. By the time they arrived, they seemed to have aged centuries. They were, Mallory realized, relics. Mallory reached into his pocket. The blue slips of betting paper were utterly safe. Their material nature had not changed in the slightest, but now these little blue slips infallibly signified the winning of £400. No, £500 in all. 50 of that to be given to the utterly victorious Mr. Michael Godwin. Mallory heard a voice ring in his ears amid the growing tumult of the crowd. "I'm rich," the voice remarked calmly. It was his own voice. He was rich. This image is a formal daguerreotype of the sort distributed by the British aristocracy among narrow circles of friendship and acquaintance. The photographer may have been Albert, the Prince Consort, a man whose much-publicized interest in scientific matters had made him an apparently genuine intimate of Britain's radical elite. The dimensions of the room and the rich drapery of its backdrop strongly suggest the photographing salon that Prince Albert maintained at Windsor Palace. The women depicted are Lady Ada Byron and her companion and soi-disant chaperone, Lady Mary Somerville. Lady Somerville, the authoress of On the Connection of the Physical Sciences, and the translator of Laplace's Celestial Mechanics, has the resigned look of a woman accustomed to the vagaries of her younger companion. Both women wear gilded sandals and white draperies, somewhat akin to a Greek toga, but strongly influenced by French neoclassicism. They are, in fact, the garments of female adepts of the Society of Light, the secret inner body and international propaganda arm of the Industrial Radical Party. The elderly Mrs. Somerville also wears a fillet of bronze, marked with astronomical symbols, a covert symbol of the high post this femme savante occupies in the councils of European science. Lady Ada, her arms bare save for a signet ring on her right forefinger, places a laurel wreath about the brow of a marble bust of Isaac Newton. Despite the careful placement of the camera, the strange garb does not flatter Lady Ada, and her face shows stress. Lady Ada was 41 years old in late June 1855 when this daguerreotype was taken. She had recently lost a large sum of money at the Derby, though her gambling losses, common knowledge among her intimates, seemed to have covered the loss of even larger sums, most likely extorted from her.
She is the Queen of Engines, the Enchantress of Number. Lord Babbage called her Little Dar. She has no formal role in government, and the brief flowering of her mathematical genius is far behind her, but she is perhaps the foremost link between her father, the great orator of the Industrial Radical Party, and Charles Babbage, the party's grey eminence and foremost social theorist. Ada is the mother. Her thoughts are closed.